Welcome to Political Rewind on GPB. It is 2:06 on Wednesday, September 14th. I'm Ricky Bevington, filling in for Bill Nigut. Joining us in the studio today, Emory University professor Andra Gillespie from the AJC, conservative columnist Kyle Wingfield, Clarkston Mayor Ted Terry, and Ted also serves as the Georgia chapter director of the Sierra Club. Joining us by Skype, AJC Washington correspondent Tamar Hollerman. Great to have you all here on the show today. Let's start with today's big political headline. Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump taped a show this morning with Dr. Oz, during which he released his doctor's physical. He actually handed the papers to Dr. Oz. We don't know the content of the doctor's physical because the show airs tomorrow on ABC. But this does come as Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton continues to recover from pneumonia. She was criticized for not disclosing her illness when she was diagnosed last week. We know she had to leave a 9/11 commemoration ceremony on Sunday in New York City due to illness. The health of presidential candidates and ultimately presidents, a big topic of conversation among Americans today. Kyle, why don't you start us off with a commentary you wrote this week?
Yeah, well, you know, I think you look at the Hillary Clinton situation a couple ways. I mean, one, certainly the health of presidential candidates is fair game. Voters have a right to know what the health condition of these people is. It's you kind of forfeit a good measure of your privacy when you run for an office like president. And, you know, it's obviously a job where there are huge consequences if you can't fulfill the term that you're elected to. On the other hand, you know, people get sick, they come down with something. What most people don't do is then go around directing people to mislead the public about what's going on with them. And you know, I think once it came out that she had been diagnosed with pneumonia 2 days before that episode in New York, and after which, you know, her staff were saying, oh, she was just overheated, or it was just this, it was that. And then you come out later and it's, you know, that they knew a couple days before that, that she was very ill and was, you know, under doctor's orders to rest and everything. It's just, you know, the illness that she has really is the inability to tell the truth, it seems. And this sort of obsession with, you know, paranoid obsession with privacy. And David Axelrod had a great comment about it, you know, that's, you know, pneumonia is curable, but this kind of paranoid focus on privacy doesn't seem to be.
And Andra, I'm going to let you respond. But first, we do have a poll right now on Twitter at PoliticsGPB asking, tell me the language again. When do you go to work sick is pretty much. Okay, my producer's telling me, when do you call in sick? We've all done it. We're not feeling great. We still go to work. So that is our question for today. And we have options for you. You can pick you can pick first signs of a cold, contagious, doctor's orders, or never. Okay, all right, there you go. We'll see what we'll be reading listener responses during the show. Andra, please respond.
So I will agree that Hillary Clinton has a problem with honesty and transparency. However, in this case, I'm actually willing to cut her some slack on this one. And I don't think she was actually intentionally trying to mislead anyone. I think, and I take her at face value on this, that she didn't think it was that big of a deal, and so therefore she didn't need to disclose it to everyone. And many people on her staff didn't know. It was only people in her inner circle who knew about the pneumonia diagnosis. So my question was, why, after a pneumonia diagnosis, did you not go home immediately and go to sleep, especially on Friday night where you could have missed the whole basket of deplorables incident by just kind of being at home in bed because you had a pneumonia diagnosis? And part of the reason why I think I identify with Hillary Clinton this week is because I am sick right now. And so I had to skip work on Thursday because I knew I wasn't feeling that great and didn't realize how bad I was. And even though I'm not at 100%, I still have to soldier through. So unless you try to touch me, I'm probably not going to tell you that, you know, I'm not quite at 100% just yet. So unless you see me coughing or sucking on a cough lozenge or anything like that. And so I think most people kind of do it that way, because oftentimes we have to. We don't have a choice. Our jobs require it. There are people who will lose their jobs if, you know, because they don't have sick leave and other types of things. So I think most people were trying to soldier through. And if Hillary Clinton is nothing but disciplined, she would be the type of person who would soldier through on this type of situation.
I can attest that Andra was not shaking hands.
I can't say
whether she was kissing babies.
Haven't done that either.
Let's actually hear what Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed said today on the health of Hillary Clinton. As we know, Kasim Reed is pretty much the biggest surrogate for Clinton here in Georgia.
And I think that this whole matter around her health and stamina is really sexist and has some very dark undertones in terms of what it says about how you treat a man and a woman.
Ted and Tamara, I want to bring you into this conversation. We've shifted slightly from health to gender. Health, of course, being what started this conversation. Ted, what do you think? Do you agree with the mayor?
Well, number one, I can attest to running for office and getting sick myself as a young, you know, I think healthy person, young invincible, maybe, under Obamacare terms, who has gotten sick in a campaign. And I think, you know, campaigns are very stressful, and it's not surprising that you're going to get sick. I would be interested actually more about their routines for diet and exercise. I think political leaders should be examples in many different ways, including how they treat their bodies. And we should be encouraging people to eat healthier and exercise. So I would be interested to see what Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump do just to stay healthy. I haven't seen really much about that. I know Bill Clinton was a big runner. George W. Bush ran and, you know, saw things on his property. and I think Obama plays basketball. Mm-hmm. So I would be interested to hear about that. I don't know about the sexist overtones. The extreme of what I saw on Twitter over the weekend was the hashtag Hillary body double, mm-hmm. you know, situation. And so you got a lot of people out there who have taken, you know, it way too far and are, I think, have used her gender to insinuate, to incite things that probably wouldn't have happened if she was a male.
Tamar Hollerman is actually joining us from the National Mall in Washington, D.C. I'd like to ask you, Tamar, about the issue of health and gender from your perspective. You're not in Georgia, but you are in D.C. covering the campaign.
You know, it sort of feels like it is politics as usual. What I've been interested to see is how much of, you know, this narrative has really started popping up more and more on the campaign trail. How sexist are people being as they're discussing Hillary Clinton? You saw it last week during the Commander-in-Chief Forum on NBC. There was some criticism that the kinds of questions that were being asked of Clinton and the way that the moderator was kind of cutting in, he wasn't treating Trump the same way. As a millennial woman, it's interesting to hear over and over again these allegations of sexism. A lot of older women have talked about how meaningful Hillary Clinton is, this idea of breaking down barriers for women. But for younger women, that doesn't matter as much to them. So I don't know how much these allegations are going to change anything or change voters' minds, but it kind of feels like politics as usual.
Andra, do you see the Clinton campaign using gender as a central campaign issue?
Oh my goodness. So, I mean, if you look at the Democratic convention, for instance, they put her femaleness up front. And so they were actually trying to emphasize the ways that actually having a woman in the White House might be better than having had all these men previous to them. They were using the stereotype of women as kind of being the moral compass as a nice contrast to Donald Trump's perceived lack of a strong temperament to be able to be president of the United States. So they have actually kind of leaned into Hillary Clinton's gender and tried to emphasize the positive ways that this could actually enhance her candidacy, especially against somebody like Donald Trump. With respect to how this relates to this health issue, I mean, and now there are the allegations that she gets a different type of media scrutiny than Donald Trump does and that it may be gendered. And I think that that's definitely a researchable proposition and we should examine it. In this particular case, based on the pneumonia, I think gender impacts it in a different way. I think Hillary Clinton's reaction was very much a condition of her own gender upbringing in terms of people suffering through. I was having this conversation with my mother, and my mother said, you know what? When you're a mom and you're sick as a dog, you still have to get up and take care of your kids. You don't get a day off. And she was thinking about it from a gendered position, and my mom is not much younger than Hillary Clinton is. So there are other ways that I think gender kind of fits into the race. And when Donald Trump talks about her stamina, when Donald Trump says she doesn't look like a president, that seems to me to be a very subtle sexist kind of dig to say that because she doesn't look like all the other potential presidents who have come before her, that somehow she's unfit. That to me strikes as very, very gendered. But the fact that we're talking about their health, I think, is open game. And, you know, I guess we'll get to sort of how Donald Trump is presenting his physical record, but, you know, that's fair too. And so, you know, so it'll be really interesting to see how we examine the two side to side to see if we see any gender differences.
Yeah, it's an interesting point about the mother thing, and certainly my experience with my own mother and my wife would confirm that they push through. Let's be very frank here. Does anyone think that if Donald Trump had passed out at an event on 9/11 or anywhere and had to be helped into a van, and you know, and there was some confusion over what exactly was wrong with him, that the reaction would be any different? I mean, I guess that part of it, for you know, when I hear that from Mayor Reed, it makes me think. I can't imagine what different sort of response there would have been to a male candidate had the exact same thing happened to them. And you know, one of the controversies we were talking about not long before this happened, you know, was how, you know, Trump's doctor had issued this statement that he'd be the healthiest president in the history of the country or the world or the universe or, you know, who knows. And then, oh, he only spent 5 minutes, right? So we have been talking about Donald Trump's health. I mean, I this is one of those times where I think the Clinton campaign's kind of grasping at whatever they can to try to tamp down What seriously I think is a really damaging episode for her. I mean, whoever you are, if you're running for president, it looks like your health could be an issue during your term. That, I mean, John McCain went through it. Ronald Reagan went through it. You know, we've seen it before.
See, but, you know, I mean, the thing is, though, I don't see how pneumonia, especially if she gets over it, is that big of a deal. And especially since they made an issue of the coughing fits, well, now pneumonia explains those coughing fits. So as long as she gets the antibiotics and gets over it, it's not like she has revealed some type of chronic debilitating type of disease that could incapacitate her. This is going to make her have bed rest for a couple of days, and I think she'll eventually get over it. So I think, you know, the idea that there may be something more sinister there, you know, we don't know what could be disclosed in the future. But right now, this is something, oh, all right, you take some antibiotics, you get some bed rest, you'll be as good as new in a few days.
And I should clarify, I think it's damaging because of the response. I agree.
Right,
I mean, like Mayor Ted said, people get sick. You know, I think people are have some grace for that, but it's the response and the feeling. You know, she's sort of lost the benefit of the doubt when it comes to getting the story straight the first time.
Tamar, I wanted you to weigh in on whether. Actually, just go ahead. I'll ask my question just quickly. We've got about a minute or two.
I think the importance of this episode is that it opens the door for a narrative that you've seen a lot in the conservative press, this idea maybe Clinton is hiding something bigger when it comes to her health. For a long time, the mainstream media kind of shrugged that off, but I think now this episode really opens the door. The media kind of has to consider those opinions that have been waged.
Do you see gender becoming more of an issue as we count down to Election Day?
Potentially. It sounds like Hillary Clinton's top surrogates are going to use any opportunity, any criticism they see of her to kind of frame it as an issue of gender. Whether that'll change the minds of especially young voters, young women, I don't know. I doubt it.
We're going to take a very short break. I want to remind our listeners that we have a poll right now related to illness. When do you go to work sick? You can let us know at PoliticsGPB. You've got a couple of options, like your doctor orders you to stay, whether you're contagious or not. Please don't go to work contagious. I'm just going to put that out there. But let us know what you think, and we'll be reading some responses on the show right now. You are tuned to Political Rewind right here on Georgia Public Broadcasting.
GPB's membership campaign begins soon, and with program costs on the rise, your support is especially important. Support GPB now at gpb.org, and you'll also enter to win a St. Simons Island getaway for two, including a 3-night oceanfront stay at the King and Prince Beach and Golf Resort. relax on the beach, enjoy scrumptious meals, or enjoy a round of golf. Your support will also encourage others to join you in supporting GPB during the drive. That's gpb.org, and thank you.
Right now, you have a chance to win a St. Simon's Island getaway for two at the King & Prince Beach & Golf Resort and support GPB at the same time. Your online contribution at gpb.org will also inspire others to join you in support of GPB during our fall membership campaign. You'll also enter our drawing to win this getaway for two, including a 3 nights oceanfront stay, golf, and even a massage. Please go now to gpb.org to do your part. That's gpb.org, and thank you for your support.
We're back to Political Rewind here on Georgia Public Broadcasting. A very good afternoon to you. I'm Ricky Bevington, filling in for Bill Nigut with a panel of experts here in the studio and an expert from Washington, D.C., Tamar Holloman of the AJC, calling in from the Washington Mall. We're discussing a couple of issues right now. We've got we've got the health of presidential candidates. We've got the gender in the campaign. I'd like to actually move now to religion. This, of course, a major conversation among Americans right now. Race is also a part of this. Right here in Georgia, the Newton County Board of Commissioners, that's in Metro Atlanta, canceled last night's planned meeting to reverse course on barring new religious construction, including a planned mosque and cemetery, because a local militia threatened an armed protest. Now, I wanted to characterize last night's protest. So what we've been able to determine, and I was not there, I will be totally transparent, I was on air, actually, here on GPB, about two dozen members of the armed militia showed up for the protest. Seen among the members were two AR-15s, a few handguns, and a megaphone. That is a direct quote from the AJC. Judging from the pictures of the AJC, our producers were able to determine there were about a half dozen counter-protesters there. The issue of protests is actually going to come up a little later in a conversation I'm going to have with Sumaya Khalifa of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta. Let's hear the perspectives of both sides right now with two sound bites from a militiaman and from the mosque of this in Newton County.
Well, the refugees are coming to the stateside. They got to go somewhere.
Traffic. I don't know that much about the religion. I know just enough to be dangerous.
We fighting these people. Maybe not the ones that's going to church up here, but they preaching hate somewhere.
When you do try to do something and they are not from the same, background, obviously there'll be some backlash. This is their right.
That, of course, were protesters and then the imam of a proposed mosque and cemetery in Newton County. Ted Terry, you are a mayor of a Metro Atlanta city. This is a very politicized issue. How would you handle this if a militia threatened a public hearing, a county commission hearing, as an elected member? How do you respond?
That's right. I would be very concerned with a protest like that. Clarkson's had a mosque in our community for 20 years now, and we have been a refugee resettlement site for the past 35 years. And so we've got Muslims, Christians, Hindus, Buddhists, all different, 60 different ethnicities and nationalities in our 1.4 square mile city. And yet we have not had an instance of domestic terrorism, religious wars during that time period. And so there is a case study that people can live in close proximity, different religions, and still get along. And one of the people interviewed kind of mentioned that, he didn't really know much about the Muslim religion. I will admit that I also did not know much about the Muslim religion until I ran for mayor and had an opportunity to do an interfaith Clarkson, Atlanta interfaith sort of, tour for 2 days where we went around to the mosques, the Hindu temple, the Baptist church, the Buddhist temple, and actually got a chance to meet people, do a worship service, eat with them, listen to music. And that is, for me personally, was eye-opening experience because the Muslims in Clarkston are very peaceful, compassionate people. They see Jesus as one of their prophets and one of their important prophets in their religion. And if you hadn't had that experience and you just look at what's on YouTube or what's happening with refugees walking across Europe, I can understand why people would be concerned. And so we've got to at least challenge ourselves to say, I don't really know much about that, but I'd like to find out more before you prejudge.
And we should say that the Newton County Commission does have a regularly scheduled meeting next Tuesday. So at the moment, we haven't heard from them on whether that will be canceled as well. Hopefully this can come to a safe conclusion before next Tuesday's meeting. But I'd like to invite Kyle and Andra to weigh in. And Tamar, of course, up on the National Mall on really what this says about, you know, about Georgia.
I mean, I think this incident is really unfortunate. You know, I watched it on the news last night, and the organizers admitted that some of the things that they said in social media were crass and probably a little intemperate. And they admitted that the optics looked bad. And so if you're planning a protest, you have a First Amendment right to protest the same way you have a First Amendment right to practice your faith or none as you see fit. But to just kind of be completely oblivious to what the optics of things look like. I mean, when you show up with semi-automatic weapons, it looks intimidating. And so that might not be as effective in terms of getting your point across. And so what could very well happen in Newton County is that the moratorium has a sunset, and the moratorium and that will sunset, and then the mosque will be allowed to be constructed as they had initially planned. But I think people have to realize that if the First Amendment works for one group, it has to work for all groups. And so the fact that Muslims can come to this country and that they can build a mosque and that they can worship in peace, that affirms the right of Christians and Jews and non-religious people and Hindus and Buddhists or anybody else to be able to practice their faith as they see fit. And so you have to be welcoming of all in order to preserve the right of your own group to exist.
But Islamophobia is not the first time we've heard of it this year. It has become a campaign issue with both candidates, right, Kyle?
It has. You know, I think in this particular situation, there are a couple things I'd say. One is, I think it's while I don't agree with the tactics of these protesters, and I don't even agree with their end goal. I think the mosque ought to be able to build their facilities, and because we do have the First Amendment, and we have further laws, you know, clarifying. Zoning laws related to religious groups as well. And so, I'm a firm believer in those things. I think it's fortunate in this case that there's not an actual application out there. Hopefully Newton County officials can take some time to defuse this slowly, create some opportunities for people to have some dialogue and kind of work this out without, you know, there's no time sensitive pressure there. But I do want to say one thing, and I want to preface this by saying in no way am I suggesting that this mosque or any particular group of Muslims is connected with ISIS. However, I do think we've seen the Islamophobia ramp up in large part because of a significant difference between the way ISIS operates and the way Al-Qaeda did. Al-Qaeda went for the spectacular attack in a place like New York. And someone in Newton County might look at that and say, well, that's really terrible, and I don't want that to happen. But they don't necessarily feel threatened by that in the way that when you see something happen in Orlando and San Bernardino, in some of these, in the heartland, there's much more of a terrorizing effect of that. In a way that we never saw with Al-Qaeda. And so I think we are seeing reactions changed because of that. And that just makes more of an imperative for people to talk with one another and get to know each other and understand that, you know, as I said, not all Muslims by any stretch of the imagination belong to ISIS. But I do think that's part of the reason we see this heightened reaction, because I think people feel more threatened in their own backyards than they did before.
Mayor Ted?
If people want to combat radicalism, they should support and welcome mosques in their community. The imams and the board of directors in our Clarkston Mosque see themselves more as a community center. And from their point of view, ISIS is preying on the people who are pushed aside, pushed into the shadows, who aren't welcome to the community. And so their number one goal is to help with after-school programs and daycare and to have that place where community can be built around their faith, which, if you go to it again, it's a very compassionate faith, not to, you know, to separate people from one side or the other. And so, you know, when you look at these lone wolf attacks, these are people who, feel like they have no hope, in this world, and they're looking to get to the next world. And the preaching that goes on at the mosque is about doing good works, you know, here on this earth, not trying to get to some other, you know, celestial place because you've killed someone.
Now, as a journalist, I'm always aware of talking about people and not letting them give their voice. So I actually recorded an interview earlier today with the head of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta, Sumaya Khalifa. Tamar Hollerman, I actually want to, right after this interview, I'd love to hear your perspective. This story about the Newton County Mosque showed up in the Washington Post. I'd love to hear your perspective on how the national media is playing out this story. But let's listen to my conversation with Sumaya Khalifa. Tell me what you're seeing in terms of Atlanta's media coverage of this particular story and larger issues involving religion and race in our communities.
Yikes. This is not the Georgia or the Atlanta that we want to project to the world. How is that impacting our image nationwide and worldwide? I have gotten messages on social media from people all over the world saying, what is going on there? Don't you live close to there? Are you okay? The image that's portrayed there is that of Georgia hating minorities, hating Muslims.
The Newton County Board of Commissioners regular meeting is scheduled for next Tuesday. What do you anticipate?
I don't know what I anticipate, but I know what I'm hoping for. I'm hoping for true leadership and holding people accountable and going by the laws of this land.
How would you characterize the counter-protesting, and I mean public on-the-street counter-protesting, going on right now?
It exists, but reading about it, 95% of the space that's given in articles is about the militia protest. And the last couple of lines is about the counter-protest. So again, if we look back at the image that we are portraying as a metro Atlanta area and as Georgia, we just hear like this little side noise out there while the militia's voice is really magnified.
Do you blame the media?
Well, you know what? Yes, I do. I do. And that's unfortunate. That's unfortunate. It's not all media, but it is. I mean, media does play a big role in sending out the messaging. Your show is excluded, of course.
Well, you have the ear of at least one journalist.
Thank you.
Sumaya Khalifa, thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Sumaya Khalifa is with the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta. And we are discussing the proposed mosque and cemetery in Newton County that has drawn some controversy in that metro Atlanta county. Tamar Hollerman, I'd like to ask you how you see the national media portraying Georgia this morning with this story.
Yeah, a few different thoughts. First of all, as journalists, I will say many things. You know, we tend to be attracted to the sexy, the raw, the sexy images. You know, when you hear about armed protests and you hear about militias, that gets people's attention. That's something that people will click on social media and on your website. I will also say, I think a reason that you're seeing a lot of national interest in this is because it really offers a window into how this really sharpened, raw rhetoric that we're seeing on the campaign trail from both campaigns is actually manifesting itself on the ground. For a year now, you've heard people like Donald Trump talk about the risk that comes with, some immigrants coming from the Middle East and the national security implications on that. This shows a group of people in the U.S. trying to figure out their reality. You know, how do we live with each other in this current environment? And then on top of that, you know, this has even gotten international media attention. I saw a few weeks ago, The Economist magazine wrote about it, with the thought being, what the heck are they doing in Georgia? So it's gotten all sorts of play.
Thank you, Tamar Hollerman. We are discussing a proposed mosque and cemetery in Newton County. And we also have a poll based on early part of this show, this conversation about the health of presidential candidates. A reminder to listeners, we have a poll right now on Twitter at PoliticsGPB, at PoliticsGPB, that's the handle. When do you call out sick? Right now we have 50% saying they call out sick when they have a contagious illness only. And another 50% saying only after doctor's orders. Apparently 0% of our respondents call out sick at the first signs of a cold. So take that to heart. I might be getting a cold. Let's move to the federal level now. Congress is back in session, and Georgia needs Congress to get some things done. many people would say, in the next couple of months on some pressing issues. We've got the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We've got Zika funding. So I'd love for Kyle and Tamar to maybe kick us off about what Georgians should be watching in the next couple of months from our congressional delegation.
I guess I'll start, Kyle. The number one thing on the agenda for Congress this month is to keep the government open. If they don't pass some sort of stopgap funding bill by September 30th, it'll be lights off for every federal agency that's considered non-essential. And for Georgia, that means, you know, there's the CDC in Georgia. There are a lot of universities that rely on federal grants. There are military bases that rely on getting continued funding for the government. So a lot of critical projects could be slowed down if there is a slowdown in funding as well. And we're also curious to see how much extra Zika money, if any at all, Congress will approve. It's been at the center of a lot of fights on Capitol Hill over the last 6 months, and it looks like they are starting to come to an agreement.
Kyle, anything to add?
Yeah, I would say that from a political, purely political perspective here, I would expect that if there is a government shutdown, we were talking about the media earlier. Republicans should fully expect that to be cast as a failure on their part, and you know, something that Democrats have tried just so genuinely to try to get done with very pure motives, and those bad Republicans have stopped them from doing that. I think we can reliably depend on that to be the way it's covered, because that's pretty much the way it's always covered. So I think it's really in the interest of congressional Republicans, not just if they want to help Donald Trump get elected, but for their own reelections and for the majority in the Senate that the Republicans are trying to hang on to and increasingly look like they just might pull it off. I think they can expect that if they can't get something done on this front, that will hurt their chances. And I will not go so far as to say that Democrats will try to keep it from happening with that in mind. Those are the political implications, I think, especially of the government funding piece.
And going off of that, Kyle, with all of that said, I think it is highly unlikely that we'll end up in a shutdown scenario this year. Members from both sides of the aisle are, you know, they're running for re-election. They want to go home and they want to campaign. And the last thing that Democrats or Republicans want is the threat of a government shutdown hanging over their head at every single public meeting that they do. They want to show people that they took care of it so that they can go home with a clean conscience. So I really don't think this will be an issue this year, especially with control of the Senate at stake.
I think you guys have just come up with our next Twitter poll. If the government shuts down, who will the media blame? Our producer is giving us the thumbs up. That's not for today. Today's Twitter poll is, when do you call out sick? You can answer it at PoliticsGPB. I'm Ricky Bevington here hosting Political Rewind, filling in for Bill Nigut, who's taking some well-deserved vacation time. You're tuned to Georgia Public Broadcasting. Thank you for joining us this Wednesday afternoon. Lots of important political issues to talk about. Affecting Georgia today. Let's take a very short break, and then I want to talk about Trans-Pacific Partnership. I want to talk about constitutional amendments that all voters are going to be asked yes or no when they vote, assuming everybody's going to vote on November 8th. So here's a quick break.
GPB's fall membership campaign is right around the corner, but don't wait to do your part. Your contribution now at gpb.org will inspire others to join you in supporting public radio as part of our Member Challenge Fund. You'll also enter the drawing to win a St. Simon's Island getaway for two at the King and Prince Beach and Golf Resort with three nights oceanfront accommodations and golf. That's gpb.org, and thank you so much.
You're tuned to Political Rewind here on Georgia Public Broadcasting. I'm Ricky Bevington. Thanks so much for tuning in this afternoon. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, also known as TPP, this is a massive trade deal, a proposed trade deal, very difficult for Georgians to understand how it impacts us. The fact of the matter is Georgia's largest industry is agriculture. That breaks out into dozens and dozens of categories, from poultry to timber to wood pellets. But this matters for our state. So, Tamara, I'd love for you to give us some top line reasons why Georgia needs to be paying attention to the TPP vote.
Sure. I mean, like you said, huge agriculture industry in the state that makes billions. There's also our new port in Savannah that they're deepening, that their leaders are hoping will be a big economic engine for the state. That really could be impacted if Congress does not approve this deal. So and all the Fortune 500 companies that are based in Atlanta, a lot of them are international and care deeply about this issue and want to see it approved.
Ted, you have told me in no uncertain terms that you are against TPP. Why
I am.
Is that?
Yes. Well, you know, just Tamara mentioned the Fortune 500 companies. You know, their executives are here, but their manufacturing might be elsewhere, or even they might be interested in bringing their manufacturing to places like Vietnam that have lower environmental regulations, lower hourly worker wages. And, you know, this is something that's united labor unions, environmentalists, some Tea Party people who look at the investor state dispute settlement situation to work out economic disagreements and potential profit losses, you know, outside the judicial branch of government. So a separate panel of arbitrators to work out disagreements between these countries. And I think the important part about just local, you know, businesses, 9 out of 10 small and medium businesses in Georgia don't rely on exports anyways, exports to other countries. And if you look at just the Korea Free Trade Agreement, agricultural exports actually went down after the Korea Free Trade Agreement between Georgia and South Korea. And so I think, you know, the cautionary tale is if it's cheaper to produce it in those trade countries than it is in Georgia, there's going to be a very, you know, there's going to be a giant sucking sound as revenue and investment, you know, favor those countries where it's easier to do business than here.
Well, both presidential candidates have said they're against this, and trade has now, I should say, in its current form, and trade has become a campaign issue, as always. Does a trade deal like this, Kyle Wingfield, kill American jobs?
Well, I think one thing that gets lost when we talk about the TPP is what it is and what it is not. And I'll start with what it is not. What it is not is a trade deal that includes China, and that is by design. You hear Donald Trump talk a lot about China this and China that. The fact is the TPP is designed to open markets to American products before China strikes the same kind of deal with those nations. This is a matter of competition and who is going to win the competition to have access to fast growing markets. We're not just talking about developing countries here. There's some developed countries involved in this deal as well. And so, you know, you think about, we've heard a lot from President Obama over the last 7 years talking about, you know, an American pivot toward the Pacific rather than the Atlantic. The ability to do business with people in those countries in that Pacific Rim is going to be very, very important in the coming decades. And if we don't do this, and I'm not certainly not saying that every aspect of it is perfect. If we don't do this, there is no do-over, you know, no easy do-over anyway. It would be a multi-year do-over. And in the meantime, China gets the chance to strike their own deals with these countries. And some of the things that people say, well, we won't have this, we won't have that, we're not going to have that either if China gets there before we do. So to me, that's the single most important factor in this is there is a race to do these kinds of deals. And we are currently winning that race in this particular case. And if we stop short of the finish line, it's not that just, well, everything stops. Everything keeps moving. It's just with different actors involved, and we won't be at the table.
Andra, Democrats traditionally are more friendly toward trade. Am I correct on that? More friendly toward trade.
With the exception of labor.
Well, I guess my point is, it's hard to know where we're supposed to fall right now on when it comes to international trade. Have you been hearing from our congressional delegation, particularly on the Democratic side, how they may vote if it comes for vote?
So that's not something that I study on a regular basis, but I think part of the reason why you have both candidates coming out against TPP is that they're both being pulled by populist forces within their own electoral coalitions. So clearly Trump has made this part of his base, and Hillary Clinton, of course, is being pulled in that direction from the progressive wing of her party. So with Bernie Sanders being in opposition to TPP, she was going to have to kind of pivot her normally kind of global cosmopolitan kind of point of view toward that point of view in order to satisfy the left flank of her party. And what this does is, this is really tapping into a lot of the discontent that's the undercurrent of this campaign. And so there are people who have been left out of globalization, and they are reacting. And so those who are more conservatively inclined have gravitated towards Donald Trump, and those who have been more liberally inclined gravitated towards Bernie Sanders, perhaps might gravitate towards Jill Stein in the general election. So I think the question is how do we reach out? How do we include these voters who are, you know, not going to be a part of the information revolution, are not going to be part of sort of the high-end service economy, where we're talking about financial services and other types of things, people who would have once gotten their jobs in manufacturing, who, you know, are going to be left out. Because the reality is, here in the United States, we're moving away from an industrial kind of manufacturing-based economy. And so all of these talks to kind of go back to that are probably in the long term not particularly realistic. So how do we train our workforce, and how do we train those young people who are going into that workforce to be a part of the new economy and to lead whatever that, you know, new economy looks like, I think are really important.
Tamar, is there a deadline after which this partnership or this proposed deal just dies if nothing happens in Washington?
Well, the most immediate deadline is the end of President Obama's term. He's kind of accepted the fact, more or less, that whoever replaces him in the White House, Trump or Clinton, they're not going to be enthused about this deal. They're not going to want to push it through Congress. So he sees it as kind of incumbent on him to go and do this in Congress's lame duck. And it is do or die. And what's interesting here, I think a lot of it will depend on who controls Congress after the election. You know, right now, when it comes to the Democrats, a lot of them, you know, side with the unions, and they're scared to, you know, push a deal like this through. And it's also divided Republicans. So there have been people who have said that right now the deal as written would not be able to pass through this current Congress. So it really will be an uphill climb for President Obama.
Well, we will be watching TTIP, and I should mention there is another major trade deal coming down the pike that I think its fate may be tied to TTIP. This is with Europe, the Transatlantic Investment Trade and Investment Partnership, TPP. TPIP. TPP is the current bill, and TTIP is the future one. And so the fate of this international trade deal, I think, actually jeopardizes potentially future trade deals. And, of course, we'll see what happens.
And to Kyle's point about China, the one you're going to hear next is BIT, the bilateral
tell us about BIT.
That's just the China. It's just America-China trade deal. And I mentioned the investor-state dispute settlement issue. I think this is going to continue to be a longstanding issue in these trade deals, because we're not talking about tariffs necessarily. We're talking about regulatory processes, you know, environmental worker regulations. And the biggest, you know, complaint you heard from the unions as well as the environmentalists is that they weren't in the negotiating room. They weren't at the table when TPP was negotiated. And so that's, you know, sort of the specter of behind closed doors, multinational corporations, the corporate class of America and of those countries are negotiating these deals that will affect workers, and workers don't even have a voice at the table. And that's where the distrust comes from.
I understand. Yeah. Okay. So I'd like to switch from congressional topics now to something that we have about 10 minutes to focus on, which is a long time in live radio, just so everybody knows, the Opportunity School Districts issue. And if you are a listener with a child in K through 12 education, or frankly, you're a taxpayer because tax dollars go toward your local school system, this impacts every single Georgian. And this is a constitutional amendment that will be on the ballot in November 8th, which is election day. You will be asked as a voter to answer yes or no on the following question. Shall the Constitution of Georgia be amended to allow the state to intervene in chronically failing public schools in order to improve student performance? This already has generated television ads on both sides, and we'd like to hear both of those ads in full. We've got the tape queued. We'll hear them in just a second. Several teacher groups and other groups have come out to put these ads together. And I will say it is a major initiative of our of Governor Nathan Deal. So let's hear those ads.
It's our job to protect our kids' quality education, but it's also our responsibility to help fix schools that chronically fail less fortunate children.
The Opportunity School District recognizes the power of a great education. It can end poverty, create opportunity for generations to come, even turn around our communities. But far too many students in Georgia aren't getting the education they deserve.
The Opportunity School District addresses an inexcusable crisis. People don't realize 127 schools in Georgia are failing 3 years in a row. It's just not fair that parents right down the street have to send their kids to those failing schools day after day.
Here's the truth about the school takeover amendment. The cost will be huge. Amendment 1 robs struggling schools of desperately needed funds and takes away $13 million from education statewide. Instead of investing in smaller class sizes, good teachers, and more resources for learning, Amendment 1 cuts money from local schools to make us pay for a whole new set of bureaucrats and an unaccountable political appointee. We just can't afford this costly school takeover. Vote no on Amendment 1.
Now, those are two television ads that just launched this week, actually, for and against something called the Opportunity School Districts, an initiative of Governor Nathan Deal. Opponents of this amendment say that the Georgia Board of Education already has strong powers to intervene with a failing school system. This would enhance those powers. And I'm wondering, Kyle, are you able to tell us what those powers are and how this amendment would actually add the state's control over a local school system?
Right. So the Board of Education does have some power to intervene now, but this would enhance that a great deal. If a school were selected for inclusion in this statewide district, the superintendent of that Opportunity School District, who would be appointed by the governor, would have four choices. One is just to take over control of the school and run it directly, you know, from that office. The second is to create kind of a deal with the local school district for certain changes to be made and for things to be done at that school in certain different ways, depending on the circumstances there. The third is to convert it into a charter school under the auspices of the State Charter Schools Commission, which was created by a constitutional amendment 4 years ago. And then the fourth is to close it, just to close it down, and the local district would not be able to have, I think the bill's language says a bill or a school of the same zoning and attendance grades, you know, the grade levels that were substantially the same as before for like 3 years, I think. So those are the four options, you know, run it themselves, make changes in concert with the local district, convert it to a charter school, shut it down. I think most people who have watched this closely expect that the one that would be used the most often would be the charter conversion. And that's certainly been the model that has been used the most in the original one of these, which is in Louisiana, and specifically in New Orleans. And that's what most of the schools there, that's what was done with them. And they've seen, you know, there are people who dispute some of these numbers, but the fact is they're graduating kids from high school at a higher rate. Their graduates are getting into college at higher rates. They're qualifying for Louisiana's sort of version of the Hope Scholarship at higher rates. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think that's the kind of progress that we're looking for in some of these schools that are just churning out dropouts.
What's been so interesting about this debate is that it's really not falling along party lines. You'd assume it, because the governor is backing it, it would be a conservative issue. But school systems all over the state, school boards, I should say, have passed resolutions against it. And it really has come down to a local control over state control. Ted, what are people in your community? You're on the ground talking to people in Clarkston every day. Do you think parents are really tapped into to what this could mean for their school system?
Yeah, I think they're learning more and more about it as the campaigns really ramp up. I mean, this, you know, this was sort of pushed through very hurriedly in the 2015 legislative session. And at the time, it was sort of like, we can't wait, we can't wait, we have to get this done now. And it left a lot of questions, I think, for people who you probably could have gotten to support this that never got addressed in the legislation. You know, talking about charter conversions, there was a really good debate about whether those charter schools should be private for-profit entities or they should be nonprofit. And the key distinction there is if you look at how the current charter schools in Georgia have performed, consistently the nonprofit ones do better than the for-profit ones. And that was a very important point that kind of just kind of got glossed over during the committee hearings. And, you know, just in terms of the cookie cutter approach, looking at it just by a school doesn't recognize the fact that most school districts have clusters. You have elementary schools feed into a middle school, feed into a high school. Two of our feeder schools, our high school and middle school in Clarkston, are on that OSD sort of list, that danger zone. And if you have one school that is being run by a separate group in between the school district doing elementary and high school, you're going to see a disjointedness in policy and curriculum, and it's going to separate the community, where I think the goal really was to bring the community closer to the, you know, to the table. And I don't see how the legislation and the mechanisms, those four options, are going to enhance that.
We should point out that most of the schools that could be affected if it were to go into effect today are in Metro Atlanta.
You know, there are a lot of issues, I think, that come here. And so there's the issue of local versus state control. There's the issue when you bring in charters of whether or not this is basically sort of moving public education into the realm of private or for-profit education. And so that's highly controversial. And so there are funding issues that I think bring a lot of people into opposition to this issue. And then there is this issue of whether or not charter schools on the whole are actually more effective at being able to educate people, particularly people who are coming from some of the most disadvantaged backgrounds. And the historic literature, as I, you know, understood it years ago when I was studying this issue, suggests that charter schools actually really are no better at educating people. Sort of, you know, on average, if you look at test scores between people in regular public schools and charter schools, the kids tend to do about the same. Parents tend to be happier, usually because they're more involved in charter schools. There are measurement issues where there's some charter schools that can conveniently kick kids out so that they don't, even though you have to take in kids by lottery, people use the expulsion mechanism to actually kick out the kids who have the most problems, and then they go back into public schools. And of course, that's going to depress numbers. So there are all of these issues that I think kind of go along with it. I think this really comes down to how much are we willing to experiment to find the right thing. And so oftentimes we have to admit there's a very low tolerance in the electorate for trying something and having it fail.
Unfortunately, I've got to wrap it up there. We could do an entire show on the Opportunity School District. I do encourage our listeners to find out more information. Again, every taxpayer, this will be certainly important to all of us. I apologize to our listeners. I can't read the results of our Twitter poll because I don't know how to use it. I'm just going to be transparent here. But we do have a poll on Twitter right now. When do you call out sick? Tell us at PoliticsGPB. This, of course, going back to the health of presidential candidates. We're out of time today. A big thanks to Andra Gillespie, Kyle Wingfield, Ted Terry, and Tamar Hollerman for joining me this afternoon. Remember, you can always tweet us at PoliticsGPB. We love hearing from you. We've got a great Twitter community. Thanks to our senior producer, Jenny Ament, producers Trevor Young and Stephen Fowler, and our intern, Robert Jameson, and our engineer, Tyler Morris. Tune in this Friday at 3 o'clock for Political Rewind, guest hosted by the fabulous Adam Ragusea. Bill will still be out enjoying his R&R. I'm Ricky Bevington. Thank you so much for joining. Have a great week.